is the Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Show. I'm Robert Mays, and joining me today, the Athletic's own Stephen Holder. Stephen, how are you?
Doing great. Looking forward to this. We are ready for the season. I know I am, at least.
It's crazy. We're recording this on Tuesday. It's going to run on Wednesday. We're 2 days away from the season. We're talking about the AFC South today, a team that will be represented during the season opener with the Texans playing the Chiefs, but a division overall that I think pretty wide open. You can make an argument for three teams pretty strongly to win this division. I'm sure we'll get into the reasons why all of them are contenders. You cover the Colts for the Athletic. I'm very excited to talk to you about them. I think they're a fascinating team for a bunch of different reasons. But before we get to the Colts, let's talk about the surprise team of last year in a lot of ways, and a team that I think a lot of people are probably picking to win this division, and that is the Tennessee Titans.
It is a fascinating division. I'll start with that. I mean, you had two playoff teams last year and then one team in the Colts that was in it until the last couple of weeks of the season. So I think you're going to have sort of a sequel of the same scenario this year, where three teams, you know, fighting for however many playoff spots it is. But Tennessee, yes, absolutely fascinating. They went from a team that I can tell you from my perspective in Indianapolis, a team that Colts fans really didn't worry about, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, when they were on the schedule, to a team now that is a force. And I think really that is a credit to Vrabel and his staff, but also a lot of the playmakers that they've acquired on that team. They're a team to be reckoned with.
They were a forgettable team. They were a team mm-hmm. that you could just kind of gloss over. They were in that 8-8 range pretty much every single year. They were a middle-of-the-road team in the first couple years with Mike Vrabel and just that regime in general. And the Ryan Tannehill trade was truly transformative. I mean, to go trade him for a fourth-round pick, pay absolutely nothing for him to be your quarterback, and to have him kind of unleash that offense in the second half of the year. I mean, Tannehill finished fifth in passing DVOA last season, first in yards per attempt, first in completion percentage over expectation. This team was third, I believe, in weighted DVOA over the course of the year, which places more emphasis on what you do late in the season. I mean, they got so hot in the back half of the year. And I think the main question for them and for the other teams in this division is how much of that success is transferable into this year. And I don't know how to answer that. We'll get into kind of some of the specifics, but just your kind of initial thought about how real that stretch from Tannehill and the offense was. What's your read on that?
You know, when you talk about it from a statistical standpoint, that's pretty real, you know? And I think when you watched it play out too, you could see examples where, okay, like, that doesn't just happen. And I think there's something to that. And I don't think we can just dismiss them as sort of a flash in the pan. I also think, first of all, I love just their physicality, their emphasis on that as an organization. And I think that also is a reflection of their coach. I love that. And they always had that. But now they've added this playmaking aspect that we are so not accustomed to seeing from this team. I think when you balance that with the physicality and the running game that they display, I don't know. I think it is something they can replicate, because you think about it, they're not totally reliant on that. You know, that's the thing. They can still line up and smash mouth you, right? And they will do that plenty. But they also have this other element. So that's where I think it's interesting. There are teams, and just from my perspective, that are just, you know, they're finesse teams. This is not a finesse team, but they have the ability to make finesse plays now, which is not something they used to have.
What I love is that they really understood who they were on offense last year. You know, Arthur Smith came into that job as the offensive coordinator with relative anonymity. I mean, no one really knew who he was. He'd never been a coordinator. He was a tight ends coach, and he did a fantastic job. And I think that's exactly right. They can be multiple things, and they knew who they were. And that's why I think some of the stuff with Tannehill is replicable. Because when he played in Miami, they had this kind of dink and dunk offense. He was never very aggressive. But and when his last year in Miami in 2018, we played the full season, he had the sixth lowest air yards in the league per completion. Last year, it was the fourth highest, went from 4.9 yards to 7.5. I think that's real. I think you can scheme aggressiveness into a quarterback and make him a fundamentally different player. And like you said with the playmakers, I think that's totally right. Getting A.J. Brown in there and kind of just asking him to get the ball in his hands and do work, that's something that's transferable. You look at Yak season per season, whether it's scheme or players, that stuff tends to be sticky. And they did a really good job of just scheming plays into the middle of the field for him, letting him work in space. I think that's going to translate. And when you have Derrick Henry in that offensive line, who really gelled in the second half of the season when Tannehill was in there, whether it's Roger Saffold getting comfortable with Tara Luan, I mean, their left side was just dominating people. And they're relying on that same formula to work this season. And while I don't think it's going to be quite as effective, I do think it still could be a top 10 offense. And if that happens, there's no reason why this team can't win the division again.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I was thinking about as you were talking that I think is kind of interesting is how much do you think, and I'll ask you a question, how much do you think just our perspective of the Titans, like the questions that we're even asking, right? Can they do this again? Is this something they can replicate? How much of that is really just a result of the fact that we never expected it? You know, it's like we were surprised because here's this, as you said, anonymous offensive coordinator. Here's this team that's never been a big play offense. This team that has been, you know, a little bit of a throwback offensively, you know, run first, well, somewhat of a run first offense, right? And so then they come out and they hit these big plays and now they're doing splashy things, and we never expected any of that. We don't talk about the Titans in this way. So I wonder how much of the very questions we're asking are a result of the fact that we just didn't see it coming.
I think that's probably true. It's hard to reconcile Ryan Tannehill with incredibly exciting quarterback. Right. And I think it is. I mean, there's in our minds, there's probably a roadblock up to that. But at the same time, if you look at some of the things that I think aren't going to be sustainable, Ryan Tannehill was the number one quarterback under pressure last year by completion percentage over expectation, all of these metrics. That is not sticky from year to year. That bounces way up and down for quarterbacks. Think about what Case Keenum did with the Vikings in 2017, and then he was really bad the year after. Tannehill has a reputation for taking a lot of bad sacks. He doesn't have good pocket presence. That's something I think will come back to earth a little bit. Their red zone efficiency last year was absolutely crazy. They were number one in touchdowns per red zone trip by a lot, which helps if you can't kick field goals and have to try to score touchdowns, which was the case for them, but still. And they were incredible on play action. They were the first team since the 2013 Broncos to average more than 11 yards per dropback on play action. Even if you think some of that stuff is the product of the staff or the players or whatever, teams typically aren't historically great from season to season. So it's not going to be what we saw last year. The question is, what is the version we see? Is it still a top eight team? Do they still beat people up and hit them over the top? If the formula still works, just not to the same extent, I believe they can still be really good.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. And I think, as you just said, being historically good from year to year, not a good bet, right? I mean, and I think the one thing we know is that I think they're still going to be a team that falls back on what they do best.
Which is okay.
And I think, yeah, exactly. So I think a lot of those numbers you're talking about probably won't hold true. It doesn't mean they won't be good in those areas, but as you said, historically good, that's probably a lot to ask. But I think if that happens, it's pretty simple, right? They fall back, as I said, fall back on what they do well, and they do it really well. So I still think they're a team to contend with. The question is, you know, how far can that take you? And I guess we will see. But I don't know. I think it's kind of nice, though, to talk about Ryan Tannehill in these terms, just because, I mean, I think we'd all written him off. And here he is now with a chance to prove or completely change the narrative forever if he can keep this going, right? So good for him.
I think it really speaks to how most quarterbacks in the NFL are in this middle ground that we don't really talk about. Like, we try to talk about who's better, you know, Matthew Stafford or blank, or this quarterback or blank. And I think we probably should admit more often how much quarterbacks are a product of their circumstances, because you see what Ryan Tannehill can do in an offense that kind of unleashes him. I think the same was true for Stafford last year. You know, Jared Goff can look like such a different player based on what's around him. And I think Ryan Tannehill is firmly in that if you surround him with the right offense and the right players, he can be very good for you, class of quarterbacks. And I think that was proven last year.
Yeah. And you know what? That is the reality is in this sort of football fantasy generation that we live in, right? Everything is all or nothing. And
yes.
And now we have statistics to measure every conceivable aspect of the sport, right? So that's another reason, right? So I think you're absolutely right. Sometimes things are guys are just who they are, and they're either going to be a little bit better or a little bit worse, but they're probably not either. You know, they're probably not this historic quarterback, historically good or historically bad. I think, look, talent is talent, and it's up to coaching and schemes and so forth to maximize that talent. Ryan Tannehill didn't get here by being a bum, right? I mean, he's had very viable skills and tangible skills that he displayed. Whether they've been utilized properly, well, that's a question.
So, and I think they are right now. And I think that was, you know, they showed that they are going to try to utilize them, that they value them with the contract that he got. I mean, obviously the huge monster deal, which I don't think anyone could have predicted. The Derrick Henry contract is a different conversation. I think you probably could have predicted it based on the production he's had the last couple of years. The question is it a smart way to spend? When we've seen the history with running back contracts recently, it has not worked out for most teams. But as somebody who's around a team pretty often and has, you know, talks to players, understands the dynamics of a locker room, how important do you think it is to hand out a contract like the Henry one and get him off the tag just as a way to kind of send a message to your locker room to create harmony, to say, we're going to reward you if you do what we need you to do? Because that to me is kind of what that contract says. Even if it's not smart on a spreadsheet, I think if you let him play this season on the tag, other guys in that locker room are probably going to notice.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Because yes, if you look at it just from a straight black and white standpoint, there are a lot of criticisms you could make about that, right? I mean, listen, I cover the Colts. We talk about what's happening in Indianapolis. Look at the same thing, right? Marlon Mack, 1,000-yard rusher last year, and what do the Colts do? They reward him by drafting Jonathan Taylor, right? So that's how we treat running backs, right? So look, you're talking to someone who understands this. But that being said, there is no question, and I have heard many, many general managers refer to the fact that your locker room leaders, you have to stand behind them. Or not, I don't even know if Derrick Henry's necessarily a quote unquote locker room leader, but he's certainly one of their premier players, right?
He's a visible guy, player. Yes.
Yes. A guy, he's the guy that's going to be on the billboard, right? So you can't on the one hand celebrate him and say he is such a huge reason for our success, and then on the other hand say, yeah, but, you know, that sends a terrible message. And especially when you're building something and you have now, you have a culture that you're building as well, which I think they're doing there, that requires everybody to be all in and on board and all those things. And you can't accomplish any of that if one of your premier players is sitting there thinking, well, what about me? Right? I think it just makes it infinitely harder to do that. So, yeah, I think this shows they get it. And they have an understanding that sometimes it's bigger than just that one player's contract and how it fits into the bigger fiscal picture. It's not only about that. There are a lot of forces at work here. You know, we could ask this question, for example, in Dallas, right? You know, how is that going to have an effect? What's happening with Dak Prescott? And I think that's a very similar question, but they're handling it very, very differently, right? So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it's important to send those messages, and I think they do matter.
I think they do too. And I mean, if you're going to bring in a guy for a fourth round pick, have him play well for 8 games and then give him $91 million in cash over the first 3 years and then throw a guy into the trash that you rode for several years before that guy got here and was drafted by the franchise, all that stuff, I understand it seems silly and that optics shouldn't be the most important thing when you're making decisions like this, but I still think that you have to understand just the ramifications that decisions like that are going to have. And I think that sometimes gets lost when we try to, you know, play faux GM and look at the way that the money goes and everything else, because I think you have to understand the human ramifications of this stuff, and we don't do that often enough.
Yeah, no question. And I think, you know, this goes back to what I kind of said earlier, just, you know, the fantasy footballization of all of this. You know, we look at it just straight from a good move, bad move perspective. Like, yeah, okay, but based on what? And what makes it a good move or a bad move, right? And we only consider very, very few factors generally. And this, when I say we, I don't mean the public. I mean us too, as media. We do the same thing.
Oh, I do it all the time. I'm as guilty of this as anybody. I'm not trying to throw stones here. I do it way too often. This is me trying to check myself more than anything else.
Yeah, no question. And I think same here. So I think it's good sometimes to step back and ask these questions. And this is a great example of why. Look, I mean, you go in that locker room, I guarantee you those guys Well, the guys who block for Derrick Henry, okay, he needs them to – they all have sort of a unity between each other. He needs them. They need him. All of that stuff matters, and I think having that sort of synergy in there, to have that kind of synergy, guys got to be content, and they got to want to be there. So it absolutely matters.
So they're going to have a little bit of a different situation next year when the cap goes down. Obviously, they have some big contracts they've handed out, which has kind of made them a contending team in the AFC. But this year, they had enough wiggle room to bring in Jadeveon Clowney. You've got to watch a lot of him over the years with him being in Houston, and now he's back in the AFC South. I just think that he's the perfect type of player for what they needed on that defense, because they're solid on that side of the ball, right? They're fine. They have some decent players, like Harold Landry, I think, could be better as he keeps developing. You know, Jayon Brown's pretty good. Kevin Byard's a really good safety. Dory Jackson's pretty good, but they don't wow you. I think they just needed like a little something else, especially in the front seven, just an agent of chaos to kind of drop in there and really just screw stuff up. And I think that's exactly what Jadeveon Clowney can give them. I don't know how good this defense is going to be, but I know that's kind of the piece that if I was looking at the depth chart and just seeing, all right, what else do they need? That's exactly the type of player I would have thrown in there.
Yeah, totally. I could not agree more. I love this signing for them. Look, I mean, you can criticize Clowney's approach to this, and yeah, is he a mercenary? Yeah, he's kind of a mercenary, right? But so what, right?
I'd be a mercenary too for $15 million a year. Just tell me who's paying me.
So yeah, I mean, is he all in? Hell, I don't know. Who cares? But you know what he's going to do. He's going to do what he always does. He may only get you 8-9 sacks, but he's going to go in there and he's going to just wreck somebody's game and just completely just mess things up, right? And that's what they pay him to do. I will tell you this. I think he's in the perfect place. I talked earlier about just sort of the sort of violence and physicality that Mike Vrabel wants his teams to play
with.
All right, so what does he do? He goes and he gets a violent and just a disastrous type of player who creates disaster, I guess, for the opponent, right? So I think we always talk about Clowney and, well, I guess the knocks on him. We always talk about, well, he's not a complete pass rusher. He's sort of sporadic, and that's true. But I still think there are ways to really throw off the entire offensive game plan without necessarily sacking the quarterback. And he does that. He's very, very disruptive. And look, you can just tell by the way teams approach him, they don't want to deal with him. Okay. They run away from the guy, right? They don't want to deal with him. So I think this is a perfect signing for them where they are on defense. And it's also a perfect signing because of the type of team they are, their personality on defense, and really having Mike Vrabel knowing how to get the most out of Clowney too.
I think his familiarity with Clowney is important. And if you look at what happened in Houston, my favorite stuff that Clowney used to do there was he would line up in the A gap or in the B gap as kind of a defensive tackle standing up on pass rush downs with Watt and Merciless in there at the same time. And I want to see them do stuff like that. I want to see him just dropped in to really create chaos and havoc with Beasley and Harold Landry on the field at the same time, Simmons there too. I think with him, they have enough bodies to do some cool stuff. The question with me in that defense, even more than the personnel, is losing Dean Pease and having Mike Vrabel kind of take over, what is that transition like? The defense hasn't been great. You know, they've been pretty average for the last few years, but I still think Dean Pease is a really respected, very talented defensive coordinator, especially when you get into money downs and he can do some creative stuff. So moving to Mike Vrabel and having him kind of take on a bigger responsibility with the defense, I'm curious to see how that looks.
Yeah, that'll be different. I absolutely agree that'll be different. And look, especially against the pass, I think, you know, seeing the Colts in particular over the years, I've seen the Colts make so many big plays against Tennessee. And so I want to know, like, is that going to continue? Is that something where they can finally sort of close the gate on those things? I mean, that has to happen, right? But I agree with you as well. I want to see Clowney do exactly that, because, like, what's the game plan for that? Like, how do you counter Jadeveon Clowney in the A-gap standing up, right? I don't even know, like, what's the audible for that? Because
I'd curl up in the fetal position and pray, but I don't know what the other teams are going to do. I think that's probably not a sound strategy in an NFL game. That'd be my only option, though.
Right, exactly. So, but yeah, I want to see them go out there and prove they can stop the pass. And I think that they have had sort of this, it's better now, but they had sort of a revolving door of corners, you know, for a while there. I think they're getting a little more stabilized now, but they gotta, I think that's what's missing. They've always been a team that up front made you work for it. I think the back end has to really kind of catch up now.
We'll see what happens at corner. I think Christian Fulton, you know, their second round pick, probably has a chance to play some this year with Logan Ryan moving on. I'll be curious to see how the snaps shake out. But let's get to a team that you know very well, and that is the Indianapolis Colts. I want to just lay something out here. I don't think we're talking enough about what the last year of the Colts has been like. I'm sure you guys talk about it ad nauseum. But on a national perspective, let's just walk through this very quickly. Just imagine that you're Chris Ballard. And you take over this team, and you have to kind of figure out the smoldering wreckage that Ryan Grigson left there. And by year two, things are just humming. You're 10-6, an incredible second half of the year. You know, you have Andrew Luck throw 4,500 yards, almost 40 touchdowns. You feel like you have a plan. We're moving in this direction. We really know exactly who we want to be and how to get there. And then your starting quarterback just disappears. I started watching The Leftovers recently. I just finished season one. It's more plausible that 2% of the world's population could disappear than what happened with Andrew Luck and the Colts. Like, it's absolutely crazy. And I just think that it's left them in this really interesting spot because you have a roster where you 2 years ago you thought we're on the brink of contention, and now you're having to figure out the most important position in sports while trying to maintain that contender elsewhere. And I think overall they've done an incredibly impressive job of trying to balance those things. And I think that right now it's left them in a really good spot for this year. I think this team is going to be pretty good.
You really kind of summed that up well. I think it's absolutely true. So Chris Ballard, he gets here in 2017. He watches the tape and he says, "Oh my God, we suck." And so I'm paraphrasing, but not by much.
It's totally fair. It's totally right. Fair.
He's like, "Whoa, what did I just do?" And so, yeah. So the first year it was kind of a joke because you still had Chuck Pagano and his staff who were not for the long, right? That was never the long-term plan. So anyway, they wiped the slate clean. 2018, here comes Frank Reich. Here comes draft capital, all of those things. And what did they do? They immediately set out to build around Andrew Luck. That's what he spent the last 2 years doing. The previous 2 years before 2020 were spent building around Andrew Luck because that was the plan. So you build up that offensive line, two starters drafted in 2018. You
go out there, you get some... It was a transformative draft. I mean, that draft, I think we don't talk about how just damn good it was to rebuild on the fly. Finding those three starters in the first 40 picks is just nuts.
I think I have called it, and I don't know if I can prove this, but I have called it the best draft in franchise history, certainly in the Indianapolis era, which spans now like, 35 years. So, yeah. It's just fantastic draft. So they get a left guard. You may have heard of him, Quentin Nelson. He's pretty good.
I have. I'm familiar with his work.
They get Braden Smith, who is a very underrated right tackle and a guy who people should keep an eye on, is going to get extended here soon. And then obviously Darius Leonard, right? So two all pros in the first 40 some picks. But anyhow, to the original point, they're building around Andrew Luck. And this is exactly what they should have been doing all along, right? What they were trying to do for years, but just didn't do it well. So finally they're doing it. And then he leaves and he retires. So now you're exactly right. They were in this position where it's like, okay, we had this ready-made team and now the biggest piece is missing. So what they're trying to do now is to try to keep the train moving, but they needed another locomotive in there. So that's, I guess, Phillip Rivers is an extra locomotive to try to keep this thing moving. We'll see. But does he have as much horsepower? We'll see.
Maybe this is just my own personal biases. People who have never heard me on a podcast or don't know this, I am one of the biggest Phillip Rivers boosters on planet Earth. I think he's a fantastic quarterback. I've always thought that he was underrated, overlooked. And I just think at his best, and not even at his best, I'm not talking about like 2010 Phillip Rivers, but the guy we've even seen over the last 5 years when he's still been playing very well. I mean, the Chargers, for all the interceptions, whatever, were still a top 10 team by passing DVOA last year. He is still a good quarterback. Everyone's talked about the familiarity with the system and with Frank Reich, and that's fine. But to me, it goes beyond that. it's his success in this type of offense. Because I think that some people, when they're considering the Andrew Luck era Colts, are thinking of this downfield, outside the numbers, vertical offense, which they were for a good chunk of his early career. And it's part of why he got the shit kicked out of him every single week. But in 2018, they did such a good job of attacking underneath the middle of the field, creating space horizontally and understanding how to attack teams that way. And that's exactly what Philip Rivers does well. I mean, think about how many deep in routes he hit to Keenan Allen. And in my mind, I'm just imagining him hitting Paris Campbell in stride coming across the field, or a deep in to T.Y. Hilton. I think he's the right quarterback for the type of offense they want to run. And I'm just not sure other people are seeing it that way.
So you just described exactly what I saw throughout training camp.
Yes, good.
And so, like, no, you're like on it. You're totally on it. And I think you're also right in saying that people don't quite understand that. I think you're right, because I was actually guilty of this too, to some extent, in terms of what I thought Philip Rivers was, because I was sort of this passive spectator of Philip Rivers, right? Before he came to Indianapolis, I was, you know, you watch the Chargers when they're relevant, and when they're not, maybe you're not paying attention, right? And so I was this sort of passive watcher, remembering, oh, he hits these big plays to Mike Williams. Look at those, all those downfield jump balls. Well, I guess they're going to be doing that here. And what I lost sight of was the fact that, like, Austin Eckler had 4,000 targets last year, you know? And so now I've really gotten a much better handle on things going back, watching the film and understanding who he is now, watching him in practice throughout training camp. And I'll tell you, I saw, and then throw in, by the way, before I go on, throw in Frank Reich and his tendencies. And what I saw is exactly that. I saw this is going to be a get it out of your hand offense. Get the ball to the playmakers, a lot of yards after catch, hopefully, at least by that's the goal. And a lot of it's going to be shortish to intermediate routes. Lots of throws to the backs, which is not new for him. The tight end will certainly be prominent, which is also a Frank Reich tenet. So they really are kind of singing from the same hymnal here, these two guys. They really are like-minded. And I think Philip is perfectly happy not having to throw the ball down the field. Number one, I don't think he's very good at that anymore. That's just not
It's not
really
his strong point anymore. This is not, you know, 2010 with, oh God, who were those guys? I'm blanking
was
so
Vincent
hard
Jackson
on their names.
Still there?
Vincent Jackson is who, yeah, I'm thinking of, and then Malcolm Floyd was the other one. Malcolm they had these Floyd. Big, tall, rangy, yes, receivers. Yeah, God, that was, yeah, good. My brain is just melting if I can't remember those guys' names.
I covered Vincent for a couple of years when he left San Diego and came to Tampa. So that's the only reason I had that on the tip of my tongue. But anyhow, and he was still, yeah. But again, like. And Vincent Jackson, that was his game, right? You know, throw the ball down the field, totally. I'll go get it because I'm 6'5", right? But
it was Norv Turner stuff. I mean, typical, right, Norv Turner vertical kind of offense.
I think we forget that exactly. That was a product of Norv Turner. It's not that Phillip Rivers can't do it. He did do it, and he was fine at it. But that's not really who he is now. And that's a good thing because I think he understands, frankly, that's going to get me in trouble, and that's not really how I'm going to win games. And to his credit, he seems perfectly fine being a guy who is three-step drop throw. All right, it won't all be that, but I'm just telling you, there will be some of that. And I think it's going to look a little different for Colts fans who maybe are accustomed to what they saw early in Andrew Luck's career. It's not going to be like that. You know, who was his first offensive coordinator? It was Bruce Arians.
Yeah, Bruce okay. Arians. And then Straczynski was there too, right? Yeah, who likes to do a lot
absolutely.
Of that stuff. I mean, it was
Pep Hamilton,
real vertical, you know, down the field. Yeah.
Very much a vertical offense. And so that's gone. I don't, not because they don't have vertical threats. They still have T.Y. Hilton. He's still a fast guy at 30 years old. Paris Campbell can get down the field too. Michael Pittman is not the fastest guy, but at his size runs pretty well. So, like, they have guys that you can throw the ball down the field to, but that's not going to be their game. And this is very much going to be get the ball to my guys and let them make plays type of approach from Philip Rivers, which I think is the right approach.
I totally agree. I think that his best strength as a quarterback is his understanding of space and the structure of defenses. There are so many throws where he'll let it go two steps before a guy's out of his break. He'll throw into a wide open area of grass. You're like, what? Where is he going with this? And then a guy breaks open, catches it in stride, and keeps running. It happens all the time. And I think that, you know, we think of T.Y. as this fast guy. You know, that's what he was pegged as early in his career. But his instincts are fantastic. And I just think him and Phillip are going to really mesh well together in a way that doesn't necessarily compute when you think about them and their careers at first glance. And the other guys underneath, it just, you have Pittman and Pascal kind of muscling guys. Campbell is a yak guy. It just, I don't know. Nyheim Hines, I think, could be a great kind of, you know, facsimile of what Austin Eckler was for him in San Diego with the Chargers. I just think about it all, like, the more and more I think about it, the more and more excited I get about this offense. And I feel like somebody should throw cold water on me, but the players, if they stay healthy, I just think are going to make this work. I feel like Reich and, like, sorry, let me do it again. 5-4-3. And I think that Reich's kind of mindset fits with that Phillip Rivers approach. They both understand space and how to attack it so well, and they have the players to do it. And then you throw in arguably the best offensive line in the league. So I don't know. If you could figure out a way why this offense wouldn't be much better than what we saw last year and kind of comparable to what we saw with Luck a couple years ago, what would be the reason?
Well, I wonder about just... The first of all, health, right?
They have a group of
wide receivers that last year, that was their biggest issue. There's no question about it. Paris Campbell, I have never seen a guy have like four fairly significant injuries in the same year. Come back from an injury, play one game, and then something else happened. Like, I think he had a sports hernia in the preseason. Then he had, I believe, a hamstring pull. Then he broke his hand. And then he broke his foot. It's like, what the hell? How's that happen? So I don't know what kind of cloud he was under last year, but I don't think he can replicate that. So, and then T.Y. Hilton had, you know, the worst injury year of his career. There's never really been an injury year, quote unquote, for T.Y. Hilton, but last year was, right? So those guys got to stay healthy. That's the one thing that can undermine them. I think the one thing I'd say is that, you know, not having the full off season and no preseason, I think it hurts a little bit, but at the same time, I wonder to some extent if it plays into their hands. Frank Reich is a really smart play caller. I think he's going to use that to his advantage because they're going to be a very different offense this year, right? So this is the same scheme, but it's going to look a lot different because their strengths are different this year. So I think that's a wash in terms of concern. But I think the point you made earlier about the understanding of football by both Phillip Rivers and particularly T.Y. Hilton, I think that is a huge, huge asset. T.Y. Hilton, for those who don't watch the Colts, he's a guy who, if you play fantasy football, right, he's probably a guy you like and know something about. But what you don't know is that for all of the credit he gets for being a guy who's fast and athletic, I would say even the bigger attribute is his ability to understand defenses. He knows, especially against zone, I have never seen a guy understand where the soft spots are better than T.Y. Hilton. He just understands. It's just a feel. And sometimes his route looks like it's a disaster. You're like, what is he doing? Well, he knows where he's going. And that's the bottom line. And so he gets there, and Phillip understands that, as you said earlier. I think that's a great explanation of what they're going to be. Those two guys playing off each other, it won't always be structured, but that's okay. You know, they're playing for the end result. So I think it's going to be fun to watch. And again, something that Colts fans may have to get a little accustomed to.
I'm curious to see what some of the specifics look like based on their personnel and based on Rivers' tendencies in the past, because the Chargers kind of typically under Rivers were near the bottom of the league in play action passes pretty much every single year. They didn't do it very often. And I always took that as a preference thing. When you have an aging quarterback that has a lot of say and approach, a lot of the time, those guys don't want to turn their back to the defense, things like that. Roethlisberger's the same way. And even Rodgers before got there was like that. But the Colts under Reich have done it a lot. They've been up near the top of the league pretty much every single year. The curious part is that Rivers is a really good play-action passer. They just never did it with the Chargers. So I'm curious kind of how those things mesh. Do the Colts do it more, or does his preference kind of, you know, take them away from that? And the other thing is, this was a team last year, and then again in 2018, used a ton of 12 personnel. I think 30% of their snaps last year, they had more than two or more tight ends on the field. I'm wondering, do you think they're going to do that a little bit less often this year because of how much depth it seems like they have at receiver?
They might. And I've actually been wondering this. It's a great question, especially now because Trey Burton is going to miss
exactly.
some time.
Yep.
And I think I would have answered this differently if you'd have asked me a couple weeks ago before that injury. I think now it's potentially more true that they use less of that lineup. I think just by virtue of not having him. And so, yeah, they've acquired a couple tight ends the last couple of days. But, look, I mean, we all know they're not going to – they signed Trey Burton for a reason, let's be honest, right? And so Frank Reich has history with him. He's the athletic kind of guy they were lacking in this offense, you know, with Eric Ebron moving on. So he was the perfect fit. Now, health-wise, there are all kinds of questions, right? But certainly in terms of the fit and the type of player he is, that was a great signing. But I still think they're going to be very tight end heavy. Even though if it's more for the running game or geared toward the running game, they rely a lot on their tight ends in the running game. You know, Jack Doyle has caught a lot of balls here, but Jack Doyle is a fantastic blocker. I've seen Jack Doyle take on defensive ends and hold his own in a one-on-one situation. Does it pretty regularly, actually. And then there's Mo Alie-Cox, who's probably much better known for being part of Shaka Smith's VCU teams in basketball, okay? But has grown, frankly, grown into a really accomplished blocker the last couple of years. This guy is 6'5", 265, and if you ran into him in a dark alley at night, you would basically call your mother and say, call your mom and tell her goodbye. It's over.
And he can move too, man. He is really impressive. Like I, every time he's on the field, I'm like, why doesn't he do more? It's one of those things that's hard for me to understand.
Yeah. I mean, remember, he's a basketball player, right? So, you know, I think they're going to be able to still take advantage of that and because they still have the receiving threat with both of those guys. I mean, clearly, Mo Alie-Cox is not the athlete that Trey Burton is. Of course he's not. And he's not as accomplished as a receiver as he is. But Jack Doyle, I think, has proven that he's a weapon in the passing game. Even if he's not necessarily a run after the catch type of guy, he's going to catch the ball and fall down. But he's going to catch the ball, okay? I guarantee you. So I just think they'll use it less, but it'll still be a staple just because for Frank Reich, that's just too important to him. You know, the versatility that he can that he has using the two tight end lineup for him from a play calling standpoint, it gives him too many advantages. So he's not going to completely go away from that. But yeah,
that makes sense.
I think you'll see a little less, and they do have a little bit more strength at receiver this year.
Part of this is just me watching 2018 tape today and seeing a few catches and being like, man, do I really like Zach Pascal? Is that a thing that's like happened? Like every time I watch him, I'm like, Zach Pascal's pretty good, man. Like I like the way he plays. He's physical. Yeah. It's always funny when you're going back and watching stuff. And it's like, man, I guess I like this guy more than I thought I did. And that was my conclusion today while watching Zach Pascal. Before we move on, let's talk about the defense real fast. I feel like the Buckner trade and the Buckner signing, one is just, again, kind of Chris Ballard picking his spots. I mean, I think one of the defining traits of his tenure has been patience and not spending money just because they had it, not going to make moves just because they thought they had to. And the Buckner trade is really going and getting a guy that's not typically available. And I just think this was a solid group, especially up front, that needed a true star. And I think that's exactly what DeForest Buckner gives them. And, you know, getting a little bit healthier, everything else, I think they're banking on that. Just presence in the pass rush and then, you know, a step forward from everybody else being what kind of takes this defense to the next level. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. First off, I would say the first thing I want to comment on is the fact that, look, I think Chris Ballard has made two very splashy personnel moves since he's been here. And well, they're probably not personnel moves. I guess trades, I guess, if you want to just put it that way. And they are, one, the 2018 trade to move down with the Jets to number six from 3-6, which netted them Quentin Nelson and others, right? So that was a spectacular move in retrospect. And then this one, the DeForest Buckner trade, the 13th overall pick, and you were never getting DeForest Buckner at number 13, right? And they had made the decision that we're not finding the franchise quarterback at number 13. They had already made that decision. So they said to themselves,
they looked at this year's class. They considered it long and hard, but there was nobody that jumped out to them.
They really did. And, you know, would they have drafted Jordan Love if he's there in the second round? Perhaps. Perhaps, yeah. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, this was an opportunity where he said this could be a transformative move, just like the 2018 move with the Jets turned out to be transformative. This was viewed in this very same light as that. So I think you're talking about, you know, Chris Ballard laying in the weeds and sort of waiting for the right move. This is exactly that. And look, in their defense, it's not exactly the same, but the basis for their defense really is Tony Dungy's scheme, right? And so a lot of similarities with the Cowboys do. Rob Marinelli has had a lot of influence on Matt Eberflus, their defensive coordinator. And so if you know anything about
those
schemes...
It's not passive. Yeah, it's not passive, right. But it's not super complicated. Not a lot of blitzing. Yeah.
It's not Lovie Smith, but it's certainly more aggressive than that. They blitz a lot more than people realize, all those things. But in order to play that scheme on a very, very fundamental level, you always have to have that three technique in the middle. And they will tell you that. I talked to Berg McFarland about this recently, in fact, and he was great. And he played in this scheme in two places. So he can tell you that. And he said, you know, you're going to, first, there's a couple of reasons. You're going to get a lot of one-on-one block opportunities. You got to win. And then, really, you have to collapse the pocket. And that allows the ball to come out faster, especially when these corners are sitting on routes and in the flats. That gives them opportunities. So this, I think, will have an impact from a turnover standpoint, not just from a rush, not just from a pass rushing standpoint, but it should have an impact from a turnover standpoint and also allowing those linebackers, who are very, very good, by the way, this one of the strengths of their team, allow those guys to really make a lot of plays this year.
Yeah, they played 33% base last season, which was up near the top of the league. And when you consider their personnel, it makes sense. I mean, they have good guys in coverage. Leaning on that, I think, is totally reasonable. But I was wondering, how do you think the defensive back kind of snaps shake out this year? Because if I'm looking at this roster, I would say that's the biggest question mark. I know they like their guys in-house more than people outside probably do. But I'm wondering how you think just the personnel is going to work out on the back end.
Yeah, so I would say, first off, that I like but don't love the secondary. And that's okay, right? I mean, you're not going to have Pro Bowl units across the roster, but it is what it is, right? They do have questions there. I think, I'll tell you this, I like the safeties. I think that group has a chance. Top to bottom, that group is pretty good. I mean, they brought in Tavon Wilson from Detroit a few weeks ago. He looks like he's going to give them some snaps. They play a three safety lineup from time to time that they use one safety in a sort of a dime linebacker role that may be Tavon Wilson. Kari Willis is a fabulous young player who people should get to know at strong safety. And then Malik Hooker is the free safety. Worlds of potential, hasn't really, I think, made good on a lot of it, but certainly has elite level potential, right? So we'll see. But corner, we'll see. Look, they have to, Xavier Rhodes has to be the player they claim he's going to be. And that for me is hard to accept without actually seeing it on Sunday. You know, I'm not there yet. Like, they haven't really tested their corners in training camp either. So it's something I just got to see. I think they'll be very physical. They'll tackle well. In the secondary, is particularly our corners. Kenny Moore, I should throw in there, by the way, you know, just a great young slot corner.
One of my favorites.
Does just all kinds of versatile things that are unique to him. But on the outside, I think that's where I have some questions. And they're going to see some passing attacks later in the season where those guys will get tested. So we'll see. I can't really comment. I need to see more. I need to see them on Sundays.
I'm curious to see what happens with Rhodes. I think putting him in spots where there's not a lot of change of direction, you're not asking him to follow guys that are really kind of shifty receivers would be good for them. I know they play a ton of zone, which, you know, may be helpful, but he was just really bad last year. I know it's a buy low thing where you're trying to just roll the dice and see what works out, but I need to see a lot more from him than I saw last season before I feel good about that secondary. Before we get to the Texans, I want to tell you guys about DraftKings. Now is the time to celebrate. Football is finally back, and DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy sports, has millions of reasons why you should be excited. To kick off the football season, DraftKings is giving new users a free shot at a $1 million top prize. DraftKings is giving new users a free shot at a $1 million top prize with a total of $3 million up for grabs for this Thursday's football contest. Getting in on Thursday's single game showdown is easy. All you have to do is download DraftKings using promo code MAYS. That's my last name, M-A-Y-S. Draft six players from the season opener. Stay under the salary cap and see how your team stacks up against the competition. So head to the app now to start making it rain. Plus, new users who sign up today on DraftKings using code MAZE will receive a free shot at the $1 million top prize with your first deposit. Nothing adds to the sweat of watching the game like having a shot at a $1 million payday. Download the DraftKings app now and use code MAZE, that's my last name, for a limited time, new users can get a free shot at the $1 million top prize and $3 million in total prizes. Don't miss the extra special week one bonus. Enter code MAZE to get a free shot at the $1 million top prize with your first deposit. That's code MAZE, only at DraftKings. Make it rain. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. All right, let's move on to another team that I think absolutely could be in contention in this division, but it's for reasons that they probably shouldn't get credit for, and that is the Houston Texans. I think there's a good chance that by week 12, we're wondering how we'd let this happen to Deshaun Watson. But it's a weird thing because I think they absolutely could be competitive this year. And you look at what they put around Deshaun, all the speed, whether it's, you know, Brandon Cooks, Kenny Stills, Will Fuller, Randall Cobb, and you bring in David Johnson, who's a fine player. But if you think about the actual product on the field, I think it's going to be okay. But that doesn't excuse the process of how we got here. It just feels like there were so many moving parts, so much money spent, and I don't know how much better this team is than they were at the end of last season, and I don't know how much better they're going to be moving forward when you consider all the moves that they made. And I think they're going to be fine because Watson is so good, but there's so many areas of this roster where I'm like, God, this is underwhelming, and they didn't have to put themselves in this position.
I cannot agree more. Listen, this has really been going on for a year plus now. Okay, we're talking about this is a team that the Colts lost to in a wild card game two years ago. 2018, the Colts get the wild card, go to Houston, beat the Texans. And that team that I saw that night from Houston, the team they have now doesn't scare me any more than that team does.
Exactly. You know? Yep.
And so
totally agree.
I'm totally with you there. And I think that's disappointing. And it shouldn't be the case. I mean, it seems like every other day there is a Houston transaction that's making news, right? And so we've gone through this entire offseason, really prior to even COVID, I think we've been talking about Houston moves. And what has it netted them, right? We're not even talking about them as being the favorite in the division. Okay. It's a competitive division, granted. But after all of these moves and machinations and money, I want to say that I'm the favorite in that division. I want to be able to say that. And you can't say that about this team. And that is not a positive reflection of what they've done.
Especially when you have the best quarterback. Especially yes. When you have a superstar quarterback.
And it's
That's
not close.
It's just he's so good. And I think that because he's so good, they're going to be okay. You think about all the speed, and I think that they're going to be able to really attack people with that speed, stretching the field, using some empty sets and throwing the ball to the running backs underneath. I get the plan. But when the plan also includes you being capped out next season without a really good roster, it's a real problem. Like David Johnson is fine, but you're taking on the David Johnson contract as part of the Hopkins deal, okay? You trade another second-round pick, so essentially you're trading the second-round pick you got for the Hopkins deal to go get Brandon Cooks. You can move on from him next year, and you don't have to pay him, but then you're going to eat the second-round pick? You traded a third-round pick for Gerrion Conley at the middle of last season. He's hurt right now, and even when he gets back, he's not necessarily in line to get snaps. I forgot about the Duke Johnson trade. I totally forgot about it. As I was listing off all of the
Hard
ways they've
track.
Waste, it is so difficult. It was so funny. I did all of these, and I was like, all right, here we go. The weird extensions for Nick Martin and Zach Cunningham, who are fine, but probably not worth what they paid them. And I totally forgot that they traded a third-round pick for Duke Johnson to not really use him, and then to go get David Johnson's contract. It's like, the final result is probably going to be okay because when you have a truly transcendent quarterback, it makes up for a lot of terrible decisions. But it still feels like the absolute best case scenario for this team is probably for them to be like 11-5. And that's if everything goes well. And I don't see paths to getting better because it's not as if they have young players who are going to ascend because they've traded away all the draft picks who would become those young players.
Yeah, I mean, It kind of feels like, this may not be a good analogy, but like, this is probably how my teachers felt in grade school when I turned in a book report and didn't read the book. You know,
yes. It's like, yes, it's what a are solid you talking B about? Minus. Yes.
But maybe I was like a good enough writer to fake it, you know? But if you really paid attention, you could tell I didn't know what the hell I was talking about, right? That's kind of how this feels. I will say, it is funny. Like, I'm looking at their depth chart. And so I look at the wide receivers and I'm like, you know what? I like that group, right?
Yes.
You could win some games with that. But then I think about
it's such
like,
a weird, conflicting set of emotions. Yes. Yes.
You know, so yeah, I don't hate this team. Not at all. It's really hard to do that. But I agree with you. I think there are two questions, and there are questions about now and questions about later. The first one is, how good are they? And are they better than last year? And then what happens, right, when the bill comes due? And the answer to both of those questions might be something that's not very positive for this team, you know? And that's the problem here. I mean, I don't know that, at least if one of those answers was a strong yes, like, okay, that makes it worth it, right? You could maybe sort of look at this, take a step back and say, okay, all right, fine. But we can't affirmatively say right now with any conviction that there's going to be a positive outcome in either of those situations.
Like, here's the thing. That's exactly the right way to frame it. If you're the Saints, right, and you're going all the way in, and you're like, you know what? This is it. We're going to give up all the draft picks. We're going to be willing to pawn off a pick to go get Jadeveon Clowney, which is the craziest thing I've ever heard and is amazing. That's yeah. fine, because you're maximizing your window and you are a ready-made title contender right now. If it doesn't matter if you're in hell in 2021 with your cap and your picks and everything else, because you're getting the most out of your players. The Texans are not doing that, and they're still screwed next year. So they went halfway with both of them, and I just think they're in a really bad spot, because I'm with you in that when you look at the offensive depth chart, you're like, okay, like, they overpaid for a lot of these guys. I don't understand the Randall Cobb contract, but the end result is probably fine. But then you look at the defense, and it's not. I have no idea how this team is going to get a pass rush this year without J.J. Watt just being otherworldly. They're not that good on the back end. They have serious questions. I mean, I think that Vernon Hargraves is slated to be their slot corner, but he's not very good. And I think that John Reed was apparently really good in camp and might supplant him. But you have a rookie slot corner, and their linebackers, even with Zach Cunningham getting that deal, are not a great group. It just, they're so underwhelming. They have a first-year play caller on that side of the ball. So even if the offense is exciting and Watson gets the most out of that skill position group and the way that they've built it, I still don't have a ton of faith in the cohesive team being somebody that can contend with Baltimore and Kansas City and everything else. And they have spent to make themselves that sort of team.
Yeah, and I think I want to emphasize what you said about the secondary in particular. So as someone who covers the Colts and has seen T.Y. Hilton eviscerate this secondary year after year after year, you keep waiting for them to figure out, you know what, we got to figure out how to stop people going down the field and over the top, right? You would think. And
they've been horrible on deep passes at times, yeah.
And here they are, right? So, I know, maybe that was just unique to the Colts, but I don't know that they were the only team making plays over the top. So, yeah, I just think to do all of this work and to still have some of these same questions, that to me is just, it's unconscionable, honestly. It really is.
I don't want people to come pull this clip when the Texans are averaging like 30 points a game. Deshaun Watson looks great. That's on the table. That is totally possible considering the talent that they have. I just do not support the process of how they got here.
Yeah.
And I think when you're really competing against teams who are doing a lot of things the smart, right way, you have to have a solid process, and that they just don't. I just don't think that they've approached this the right way to set themselves up for success, either in the short term or the long term. I'm excited to watch this team because I truly think that Deshaun Watson is a special player deserving of every cent that he got on that contract extension. But I just don't think this team, as constructed with the leadership they've had, has put themselves in position to really push the best teams in the league.
There's no question about it. And look, I mean, Bill O'Brien, at some point, okay, look, I get that he's been empowered, but at some point, even he has to show some results for all of this. I mean, he just does. And I don't know what that point is and when that comes. And I don't know what the inner workings are of their organization in terms of, you know, what ownership thinks necessarily. Clearly, ownership has a different opinion than we do, maybe, but certainly at some point, It has to pay off. Look, J.J. Watt is not getting any younger. You have, as you said, all these questions on defense. You have a young quarterback who's going to be, he's very happy right now, clearly. He should be, right? But he's not, he didn't sign up to have to do this every year, to have to save this team from itself. That's, he didn't sign a contract extension for that. So, you know, we talked earlier about Derrick Henry and wanting, and how, you know, the Titans making an effort to keep him content. There are other ways and other things to consider when it comes to keeping players content too. It's not just money, right? That player has to feel like his efforts aren't being wasted and that he's not doing this for nothing. And that there's an end game to all of this, you know, what's the end result? Where are we going? And so we're not there yet. And maybe we never get there because Deshaun Watson is just a wonderful young man, but you got to wonder if things don't happen for them the way they want to and results don't come, when and if those questions are asked.
That's my biggest thing. I just, it's too easy to see a future where we're sitting here a year from now after, you know, I don't wish, you know, injuries on anyone, but Will Fuller has had trouble staying healthy. Brandon Cooks has had trouble staying on the field. I'm just really concerned that we're sitting here in August of 2021 with both of those guys no longer on the roster and with this team not having any money, being like, what are we going to do with Deshaun Watson? Why are they wasting Deshaun Watson? It's just too easy to predict that coming, and it concerns me.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. And if you're a Houston fan, how can you not ask these questions? I mean, look, they love their football down there, and I understand that they have a lot of reason for optimism. I mean, namely the quarterback. But again, look, a lot of fan bases have been through this, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the reaction locally is if this continues and the results, as I said, you know, don't come, at least not the level of results that are expected.
Before we move on, I want to tell you guys about a special offer for our listeners. Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually, men just brush it off or blame themselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo, or they avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry, honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it's easy to talk about. With a real healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication, it's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. A healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/maze and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/maze today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of ED treatment. That's GetRoman.com/maze. GetRoman.com/MAYS.
All right, let's move on to a team that, unlike the Houston Texans, is not trying to maximize its window right now, and that is the Jacksonville Jaguars. I kind of hesitate to kind of the way we should approach the Jags with this show, because it's almost like they're post-preview right now. Like, previewing their 2020 season doesn't seem to have a lot of value. They've traded away all of their big-name players in the last, like, 2 months. I mean, we're like 3 years removed from this being a truly transcendent defense. And now Calais Campbell's on a different team. AJ Boye is on a different team. Yannick Ngakoue is on a different team. They just traded away Ronnie Harrison, which seems a little counterintuitive. He's a young player that you might have been able to build with, but now he's gone too. Leonard Fournette's out of here. I just don't know what to expect from this team this year, because even if Gardner Minshew is really good, and I think that's possible, you know, their skill position players are interesting. I think Jay Gruden is a really good play caller. How good does Gardner Minshew need to be if they have the number one pick for this team to not pick Trevor Lawrence? It just seems like they're in a holding pattern for the future. And what happens this year in a lot of ways is almost, I don't want to say irrelevant, but it's not the most important thing.
No, I totally agree with that. Look, I think, first of all, you just pose a very important question, right? So here they are developing Gardner Minshew, and doing actually a decent job of it, it looks like, so far, right? I mean, the Colts went down there in week 17, and he had a day, right? He had a big day. And it was kind of, I think, one of the games that led you to that conclusion, led people to that conclusion that, you know what? He might be a guy. We might have a shot with this kid. But as you said, if this season goes where we think it might, then what do you do? That would be such a fascinating question. I mean, here you have this potentially transcendent quarterback prospect, and a team, as I said, has been developing a quarterback. If he continues to develop this year, I don't know, man. I think that might end up being a trade scenario, I would think, is what that would probably result in, I would imagine. But it's interesting. I think they have to figure out, like, what's their strategy? Because that's what I don't really know right now. Is this really just like we're trading and releasing all of our talent and just trying to clear the books for like some big splash next year? I don't know. Like, what's the strategy? I don't know that answer is clear.
I think if you look at the way they've built and you look at some of the relative strengths on this roster, the offensive line is solid but not great. And if you want to keep that group in place, which they absolutely can, you know, they have young guys up there, Cam Robinson, you know, Juwan Taylor. That's a group, you know, two bookend tackles. This is the Trevor Lawrence plan. If you want to kind of abide by that, you have a solid line that he can play behind initially. The receivers, I think, could be really solid. You know, DJ Chark is a good player. I'm excited for what LaVisca Chenault can bring them. So you have kind of a ready-made offense for a great quarterback. It's somebody that it's a functional group of players. So that part of the rebuild, I completely understand. The defense, you tore it down to the studs. So now you have Josh Allen essentially in year two. What can he be? Kalaven Chase on your, you have a lot of young players on that side, so you kind of see what sticks there. I understand it as a rebuild, but it is a full-scale rebuild. I mean, we can talk all we want about what Gardner Minshew can do and everything else, but it seems like he's playing for a highly paid backup job or a job elsewhere, because I can't imagine this team being very good next year. And because they've tried so consciously to tear it down and rebuild it, I just don't think that he's probably in the plans. I mean, maybe I'm misreading that, but it would shock me if they were near the top of the draft, if they didn't pick a really good quarterback prospect in what is supposed to be a very good quarterback draft.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because they've made do at quarterback for so long with guys who clearly were not good enough, right? They've just kind of gotten by at quarterback, even when they were good, right? They were just getting by with Blake Bortles. Blake Bortles went to an AFC championship game, okay? I just said that out loud. I can't believe that. But
it's still
amazing. I agree.
Football is so weird.
Like, that happened. And it was only what was that? 3 years ago? 4 years ago?
2017. Flash in the pan defenses, man, are like, they are something else. The 2018 Bears being a really good team is something that will continue to boggle my mind.
Remember when they were really good like 2 years ago? Because it feels like
it goes away very fast. The great defenses are fleeting. We discussed that with Lewis Riddick yesterday.
That's so interesting. So interesting. But yeah, I agree with you. I think if I am running that football team, number one, certainly support for that team, from the fan base, I should say, has always been fleeting, right? So I'm not suggesting this is why you make draft decisions or anything like that, but that's certainly a factor, right? It's not something you can ignore when half your stadium's empty. And so, yeah, I think they're in a position where they're building toward the future, and you buy yourself time too, by the way, when you're leading a football team. You buy yourself a lot of time by going and getting a big-time quarterback prospect, right? So I'm not suggesting that's the motivation for doing it either, but all of these things, I think, impact decision-making. So I would agree. I think if they're at the top of the draft, they have to go that route. They have to, as you said, though, they have to keep working on that defense, because they have come so far in the opposite direction, the wrong direction from where they were. I'm just looking at this depth chart. It's really disappointing when you think about where they were just a couple of years ago. Where, I mean, I remember Frank Gore telling me, who is one of my favorite players I've ever covered and has played against like four generations of the NFL now. Okay. I remember Frank Gore telling me when he was in Indianapolis, he said, you know what? He says, this was a couple of years ago now. He said, there's no front I hate playing more than Jacksonville. And he said that. He said, I hate playing Jacksonville's defensive front. No one is saying that now, right? So it's just hard to sort of reconcile.
Amazing.
It really is
it's
hard to reconcile.
It's truly amazing. I mean, when you just you look at it, it's just like, man. I mean, Josh Allen, I think, can be a really nice player. I thought he was impressive as a rookie in stretches. I mean, but other than that, and like Miles Jack, it's completely new. I mean, they're really starting over. And as a plan, I don't hate that. I completely understand, I mean, things that happen like in Miami or like with the Browns and just saying, we're going to go all in on this and that's what's going to happen. Especially if you have guys who clearly did not enjoy their time there and were kind of poisoned by the previous regime. I mean, Yannick Ngakoue and Ronnie Harrison were not quiet, and Jalen Ramsey too, were not quiet about their displeasure with how that organization was run. And I think completely starting over isn't the worst idea in the world. You have to set yourself up well for when that quarterback gets there and what the plan is going to be when he gets there. And I think so far, they've done okay in doing that. If you dropped a really good quarterback onto this offense tomorrow, I think they'd be okay. I think with Minshew, they could be exciting in spurts, but I, as an overall rebuild plan, I don't think that they're approaching this in the wrong way. I just think that right now, what happens this season for them in a lot of ways just doesn't matter.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The other thing that's kind of interesting, maybe only to me, is, you know, you talked about Jalen Ramsey and, you know, Yannick, for example. Why is it that there have now been sort of a series of players who clearly didn't want to be there and did not like being part of that organization? I don't know that we've asked that question enough, or I don't know what the answer is, certainly. It's kind of interesting to me. I don't know, you know, maybe not to make this, you know, like the Houston conversation, but it is interesting. I'm curious what is happening in there, in that organization, that has led those players to reach that place where they want out of there. Where, I mean, didn't Yannick makes financial concessions to make that happen, right? Significant financial concessions, right? So it's interesting.
I think it's a totally relevant question, and I think it's an important question. And having, you know, Tom Coughlin not there anymore, giving power back to David Caldwell, likely moving on from Doug Marrone after the season, that would be my guess. You know, if they're really going to restart, I would assume they restart with a new coach. So that's the biggest question. Now with new leadership in place, which in the front office is old leadership, but we've seen that work out in other places, whether it's Philly or whatever, is the new regime, whatever it looks like, can they kind of clean out the stench of whatever the previous regime was? Can you make your franchise a place that players want to be and a place that players are developed in-house? Because that was one of the biggest issues to me, is that a lot of the guys they brought in that they paid were outside guys, or it was Blake Bortles. And I think the guys that didn't get paid noticed that, and it rubbed some guys the wrong way, and it was just a place that people didn't want to be. Can you make it a place that people want to be and have the circumstances be comfortable for whatever quarterback you're going to bring in there? That to me is the number one just goal they should have this year. If they can accomplish that, they could win two games and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, and a part of this process has to be, and I know this word is overused and sometimes we don't even necessarily use it in the right fashion, but for me, rebuilding an organization or a roster or a franchise, a big part of rebuilding needs to be building a culture too, okay? Because now we're seeing that happen in places like Tennessee, and we talked about Indianapolis. I think the culture in those two places is a big part of the success too, right? And so I think we can talk about that in other successful franchises too. Whatever your culture is, whatever buzzwords you like, whatever, it's not even about those words. It's not what you say, it's what you do. And I think that has to be a big part of this too. So that will impact the types of players you acquire too. Because you need to make sure you get players who can help you establish that culture. It'll be a different coach, I suspect, as you said. But when that happens, when and if that happens, that needs to be a big emphasis. And I think that's going to have a lot of impact on who they sign, draft, etc.
All right. Moment of truth here. Who is winning the AFC South?
All right, so I knew we would come to this moment. And so, all right, we've clearly established I cover the Colts. This is my eighth season covering the Colts. So, like, yeah, it's been a while. But this is not going to be a decision driven by the fact that I'm a homer, because I'm not, right? And I think I can show you 100 stories to prove that. I have made enough enemies in that building to establish
that. I don't think
that
anyone would accuse you of that.
Right. But I honestly, I'm telling you, man, listen, I want to say Tennessee, but I don't believe it. I really don't. And not because I don't like them. I think the Colts have the team that I think has the most weapons and the most potential in this division. I don't know if they're going to make good on the potential, but they got the most potential in my mind in this division. And when I say that, I mean top to bottom. I think when you look at the quarterback position being certainly good enough. Great? No. Good enough? Yes. The playmakers on offense, on paper, which is all I got, and what they can potentially be on defense, which is pretty good. Not elite, maybe, but pretty good and pretty solid. I think good enough. I think it's enough to win the division. Look, they were barely out of it last year. I mean, Tennessee got hot at the end. Colts lost some close games, had a ton of injuries. But they did that with Jacoby Brissett, you know, really not even throwing the ball beyond the first down marker, right? So, look, I really think the Colts are the team that has the most upside of all the teams in this division. That's my feeling right now. I think they're going to win it.
I'm totally with you. People that accuse me of being a Bears fan and having that be what colors my analysis with stuff, they're wrong. The thing that colors my analysis the most, the biggest bias that I have, is toward Philip Rivers. I'm way more of a Philip Rivers homer than I am a Bears homer. And I just think that what he's going to give this offense and how he meshes with the personnel and the coaching staff they have there, I think the result is going to be really good. I still think he's got a lot in the tank. And I think that team is going to win the division and be something that we enjoy watching this year. Steven, thank you so much for doing this. I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you for humoring me with all the other teams in this division. It was great to spend some time with you, and people should definitely go check out Steven's work on The Athletic. Does a great job covering the Colts. Just wrote about Philip Rivers, a story that I plan on reading a little bit later this afternoon. So thanks a lot, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Robert.
All right, guys, that's all we have for now. We will be back tomorrow with the NFC South and my friend Kat Terrell. And tomorrow there will be football, which I'm very excited about. Until then, thank you so much for listening to The Athletic Football Show. Please rate and review us on your favorite podcasting app. We will be back tomorrow. Talk to you guys then.
This was The Athletic Football Show.